This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Later on today's show, we'll learn about obsessive-compulsive disorder and ways to treat it, and we'll hear about a new type of stress test for heart patients. But first, Nathaniel Jones was the first African-American to be an assistant United States attorney in Ohio. He was an assistant general counsel of the Kerner Commission, which looked into the causes of the 1967 racial unrest in the U.S. As NAACP general counsel, he coordinated the legal battle against school segregation. And in 1979, he was nominated to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit by President Jimmy Carter. Retired from the court for 14 years now, Judge Jones has written a memoir, Answering the Call, an autobiography of the modern struggle to end racial discrimination in America. And he joins us this afternoon to discuss his new book and the continuing battle for civil rights. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Judge Jones, so good to see you this afternoon.
Thank you. It's good to be here with you, sir.
Let's start with the title of the book, Answering the Call. Now, what is the call? What is that referring to?
The call refers to the, in many respects, the founding of the NAACP in 1909. That was necessitated by a riot that took place in Springfield, Illinois, the home of President Lincoln. There were riots and violence, acts of violence all over the country. But this one in Springfield was of special significance because it was the home of the man who issued the Emancipation Proclamation and was the person who struck a blow against slavery. The riot in Springfield was so horrendous that a group of black and white citizens decided to meet in New York to discuss the state of race relations. The meeting in New York reviewed a list of the grievances, the acts of violence that had taken place and were taking place. It was what I call, as a lawyer, a bill of particulars that just listed these grievances with some specificity. And the ultimate resolution that was adopted was a call to all Americans to mount an attack upon these acts of violence and this condition of racism which pervaded the country. So it was a call to on the part of Americans to answer to their better angels. Attack discrimination in the criminal justice system. Attack acts of violence. Attack job discrimination. The whole range of acts of discrimination that emanated from notions of racism, and that led the conveners to organize the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, known as the NAACP, and that was founded on Lincoln's birthday, February 12th, 1909, and the organization has been in existence since that time, and it has expanded, has branches in some 2,200 cities across the country. And it has been and remains the preeminent civil rights organization in the country.
Well, what led you to write this book?
Well, from the time I was a youngster, I was exposed to persons who were challenging the status quo. I would attend Sunday afternoon forum in my hometown and listen to these national speakers talk about the conditions that were prevailing in the country and what had to be done and what was being done to address them. See, that was the period of separate but equal. Separate but equal was a doctrine that was promulgated by the U.S. Supreme Court in the famous case of Plessy versus Ferguson in 1863. What happened with that doctrine was to actually nullify the 14th Amendment. Now, we know the 14th Amendment became a part of the Constitution along with the 13th and the 15th Amendment to give citizenship rights or to recognize citizenship rights of former slaves, because there had been a decision by the United States Supreme Court in 1857 known as the Dred Scott case. Dred Scott was a slave who had been sold into freedom and had been living in the North. And then after he was a free man, he happened to go back to Missouri, which was a slave state. And there was an attempt made to return him to slavery. And he maintained that, no, he was a free man. And the case went all the way up to the United States Supreme Court. And in an opinion written by the Chief Justice at that time, Roger Taney, he held that a former slave, black people, were not within the contemplation of the framers of the Constitution, that they did not intend to include people of color or slaves within their definition of we the people. And so in his opinion, which is which makes for interesting reading these days, in 25 different places in his opinion, he identified black people as subhuman, as persons, as non-persons, who had no rights that white people were bound to respect. Well, that's what led Lincoln to issue the Emancipation Proclamation, along with some political matters related to the Civil War. And following that, the country ratified the 13th Amendment, which stated that all persons born and naturalized in the United States are citizens. And then it became necessary to add to that with the 14th Amendment that held that no state. Because in the meantime, states were ignoring the 13th Amendment, and with this, with the addition of the 14th Amendment, there was language that said no state can deny to any citizen thereof the equal protection of the laws, or deny them rights without due process of law. That's a key amendment. And then the 15th Amendment dealt with the right to vote. Well, all of those amendments, certainly the 14th and 15th Amendments, are in play right now because the decision, the Plessy versus Ferguson decision, actually nullified that 14th Amendment provisions. It deprived by its language the claim of blacks to be citizens, because the decision held was that, well, yes, states are free, even with the 14th Amendment, they're free to separate people and discriminate against people and isolate them on the basis of color, so long as the facilities to which they are relegated are equal to those that are available to whites. So that was the beginning of separate but equal. And after the founding of the NAACP in 1909, they began to challenge that concept because they knew, the leaders of the NAACP at that time knew, there was no such thing as equality and separation. But they were going to press the states to make the separate facilities, in fact, equal. And that was leading to a virtual bankruptcy of states. And so they tested the different systems in this country. They tested the school systems. colleges, universities.
And we've made a lot of progress since those days. And I think part of the reason you wrote the book, Judge, is you have a concern about backtracking on all the progress that we've made.
Well, actually, the attacks on separate but equal didn't bear fruit until 1954 with the Brown decision, mm-hmm. Brown versus Board of Education. But there had been a lot of activity between Plessy and the time of Brown. Then after Brown became the law, it said that there is that segregation of people on the basis of race creates an inherently unequal situation. Well, then the effort was made to desegregate in the South, the schools in the South, and those schools resisted. They resisted fiercely, violently, and it wasn't until after the Supreme Court lost patience with the South's resistance that it came down with some decrees that ordered desegregation to occur immediately, as soon as the case.
That's what they call Brown II, isn't it?
Brown II,
where they came out with the schedule.
Brown II called for all deliberate speed. And that's what caused a lot of the problems. In fact, one of the reasons that I wound up as general counsel was that a lawyer on the staff wrote a piece in a New York Times magazine in 1968 in which he criticized the Supreme Court for its all deliberate speed, because that gave the southern school districts and southern governors and other officials a reason for stalling and delaying. And in exasperation, the Supreme Court, of course, had to deal with that. But this young man who was on the staff of the NAACP wrote this piece entitled Nine Men in Black Who Think White. Well, that came out on the very weekend that the national board of the NAACP was meeting, and they were furious because if there's anything that the NAACP claims as a great achievement, monumental achievement, it's Brown versus Board of Education, and they didn't take kindly to a member of the staff criticizing that court. Well, when he refused to, when the officials looked into that and noted that this piece was written by staff lawyer, they wanted him fired, and he was fired, which created a reason for a walkout. All the lawyers walked out, the whole legal department. Jump ship, and that created a vacuum, and that position was vacant for some period of time when Mr. Wilkins, Roy Wilkins, the executive secretary of the NAACP, whom I had known since I was a kid, he asked me to come to New York and visit with him, and it was on that visit that he asked me to become the general counsel, and that's how I got really moved to the national stage in this matter of civil rights. But I had been involved in civil rights in my local community and in college and other respects. So I moved to the national stage, and we at that time we had about 1,800 branches.
And hang on to that thought, Judge. We need to take a quick break here.
Sure.
And we'll come back to this. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. My guest this afternoon, retired Federal Appeals Court Judge Nathaniel Jones. His new book is Answering the Call, an autobiography of the modern struggle to end racial discrimination in America. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. So, Judge, you went to New York. Were you expecting to be offered that position that puts you on the national stage like this?
No, and I was quite troubled as to whether I should accept it. And I came home and talked to some friends, and I talked to a federal judge who was a friend, and I told him that I was in a dilemma. And he said, well, what's the problem? I said, I don't know whether I should take it or not. And then he asked me a couple questions about the NAACP and the general counsel. And he said, now, how old is that organization? At that time, it was 60 years old. And he said, how many generals counsel has it had that time? And I did a little check in my fingers, and I said, well, there was Charles Houston, there was Thurgood Marshall, and Robert Carter. He said, you mean you'd be the fourth general counsel in 60 years? I said, yes. He said, you know, given the nature of that organization and that responsibility that you're being asked to take, consider that a call. He says, you don't walk away from a call. He said, you have no obligation. I said, the only obligation you have is to accept it. And that was rather compelling. And so I dropped what I was doing, and I, even before I began my duties, I was asked by Mr. Wilkins to go out to California to work on a major case, San Fernando State College. There had been a student takeover, and 100 students had been arrested, black and brown students, and charged with felonies. And it was a really serious issue. And so I went out and organized a legal team, and we provided defense for those young people. And the upshot was all of them got back in school. The charges were dismissed, and most of them graduated and moved on with their lives. But that's even before I began my official duties. So I sort of hit the ground running.
You certainly did. You know? How did you feel when President Carter appointed you to be on the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals? What was that like for you?
Like a dream.
Was it? Did you feel, is pinch me somebody, I might be
yes.
dreaming, that kind of thing?
I was at the White House at a reception that the president was hosting. It was a reception to commemorate the 25th anniversary of the Brown decision. I started not go, but then I was urged to go, that I was told that it's discourteous to decline a White House invitation. And so I went, and there were about 400 persons in attendance, and we were there, and the president came in and began speaking. He talked about how important the Brown decision was to him as a Southerner, as a former state senator and former governor of a southern state. And as president, he was attempting to carry out the spirit of Brown in his appointments. And he identified a number of people sitting around who were at the reception, cabinet members, judges, persons holding other high-ranking positions. And he said, and so today I'm pleased to announce my appointment of, of Nat Jones to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. And I thought, actually, I was dreaming, in that I would wake up any minute and realize I was dreaming. But it was for real.
Wow. It seems that as a country, we're more at odds racially than we have been in decades. How do you think where we are today compares to, say, the 1950s, 1960s?
Well, what we were doing in the 50s and 60s, and actually what we were doing since Plessy versus Ferguson, we were trying to eliminate states' rights. We were trying to eliminate separate but equal, and to have the government enforce the Constitution, so that the persons who had been victimized by slavery and by Jim Crow could enjoy first-class citizenship. Well, as progress was being made, there was a stiffening of the opposition. And so the battle was joined in many respects to return the country to states' rights, because it was states' rights, the contention that states could do what they wished in their treatment of people, irrespective of what the Constitution said, that led to segregation and Jim Crow. With the Brown decision, that was destroyed. The Brown decision destroyed separate but equal. It destroyed states' rights with regard to civil rights. And that was something that the southern states had a hard time swallowing. Well, as the progress continued, there was, a stiffening of the resistance. Consequently, political forces merged who felt that they were being victimized by these remedies that were being directed by the courts. School desegregation, employment discrimination was being eliminated, affirmative action came into play. And there were persons who felt that, certainly from the white community, that they were somehow victimized because they had to share the pie. And in sharing the pie, they felt they were victims of discrimination. And so the term reverse discrimination took hold as a political weapon. And so it became a force, and it was very effective in presidential elections. In fact, when Richard Nixon was running for president, he championed states' rights, and he developed a Southern strategy to restore, that would restore the South to its previous position of dominance, and would dilute the federal the strength of the federal government, the federal courts. And he did that by the way he appointed judges and justices to the court. He tried to appoint the most conservative, reactionary judges that he could find. And during that time, though, the Senate was dominated by Republicans, by Democrats. So they were able to challenge the nominees for the Supreme Court. You may remember the case of Haynesworth and Carswell. They were rejected by the Senate because they had aspects of their background that indicated a sympathy for segregation. And then he finally got through someone who was a little more moderate.
And it's hard to believe, too, Judge, you're talking about a period of time that was only 40 years ago.
Yes.
That it's that recent.
Right.
What do you recommend in terms of what do we need to do today as far as dealing with the racial divide that we're experiencing now?
Well, right now, there's no secret that this tug of war over the nominee that President Obama has put forth to succeed Justice Scalia is all about race. It's because it's known, frankly, the Republicans know that whoever's elected president will have 2 to 3 appointments to the Supreme Court. And those appointments can change the direction of this country in terms of social issues and certainly racial issues.
So when someone says the Supreme Court's a very important issue in this year's election, you'd agree?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And why that's so important is pretty simple, and I feel it very strongly. There's what I call a new jurisprudence emerging that began emerging with President Reagan. If people forget that when he opened his campaign in 1980, he didn't open it in Chicago or New York or California. He went to Jackson. He went down to Mississippi, Philadelphia, Mississippi, to open his campaign and to declare in that speech that if elected, he was going to bring about a sea change, and that's his term, a sea change in the makeup of the federal courts, because he knew the South was unhappy with Earl Warren and Thurgood Marshall and Justice Brennan and the justices who had issued these various Supreme Court decisions. And he said he would remove those judges and bring on what he called judges who were strict constructionists. Strict constructionists are people who advocated construing the Constitution by the black letter, by the words themselves, which meant that if we went back to the founding fathers and insisted that we had to adhere to their thinking at the time, I would not be a citizen.
And Judge, I apologize. We've run out of time here. I do apologize for that.
No, well, thanks for the opportunity.
Well, and again, to you, it's very important as far as the ongoing battle for civil rights continues through the legal system, and the court is obviously a very important issue.
Without question.
Judge Jones, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
My pleasure.
Nathaniel Jones, his new book is Answering the Call, an autobiography of the modern struggle to end racial discrimination in America. Coming up, we'll learn more about OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, and in Focus on Technology, why a stress test could soon feel like going to the moon. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.